Please feel free to turn this way for the lecture. It's a great pleasure and a great joy to be back here again with all of you. And this morning, when I got here a few hours ago, Tina asked something like, "How do you do this?" And I'm able to do it because of all of you. Not long ago, I was getting on a plane in Japan, some months ago, flying to London. There was a guy, could hear by his speech, British guy, flying back to London. I was on my way to Heathrow for a retreat in England. I do this a couple times a year, so I'm pretty familiar with the routine. Often these people, maybe our tourists, they've come for a week to visit Tokyo, Osaka, Nara, like that. Or maybe they are scientists and they've come for a conference, often their first time to Japan. They've maybe had a chance to do some sightseeing. Anyway, I flew from Osaka to Tokyo and then was flying from Tokyo direct to London. So we're sitting in the airport in Tokyo, and this is, I guess, February. Very clear sky, and I happened to look out at a little plane window, you know, the little windows. Incredible view of Mount Fuji. You know, the top half is covered in snow, perfectly round, just right out the window. It's not very clear most of the year, but in the winter sometimes it is. Just gorgeous. Well, I couldn't help it. I thought it might be his only chance. So I said, there's a really beautiful view of Mount Fuji out there. He didn't seem so interested somehow. So I kind of actually bent him down a little bit because the windows are so small, so that he could look. And he kind of looked out and, you know, didn't. Anyway, about 10 hours later, as we were coming to the end of the flight, little breakfast is passed around, so I thought I would strike up a conversation with him. So something like, it was, so how, did you see the view of Mount Fuji? And he said something like, well, actually, I've lived at the foot of Mount Fuji for 18 years now. Sometimes when I look out the plane, I can see my house. So then we had a really good laugh, and we exchanged our meishi, our greeting cards, and promised we would visit each other. But I was under the impression that he was a newcomer, so he needed to see Mount Fuji. He was under the impression that I was a newcomer, who had for the first time seen Mount Fuji and was really excited in trying to tell him about it. So Turns out he had lived there 18 years at the foot of Mount Fuji. I lived in Japan 33 years, not at the foot of Mount Fuji, but we reached a good common understanding. Of course, that's what Zen is all about, isn't it? In genuine Zen Buddhism, a worthy student is never taught. Guided, yes. Inspired, yes. When needed, challenged, yes. But not taught. Do you see why? It's essential that each of us directly realize it for ourselves. The real thing cannot be taught. The real thing doesn't need to be taught. At the same time, a genuine teacher and Dharma friends, all of us, offer great support and inspiration on the way. Through mutual respect and trust, valuable guidance naturally emerges, and when needed, a real challenge. But we are careful not to let anything get in the way of each one of us realizing ourselves. Common obstacles include over-reliance on the teacher, an obsession over perfecting meditation techniques in order to dwell in emptiness or have some enlightenment experience. With this in mind, I will comment during the lectures in this retreat on the classic Zazen manual. In Japanese, it's called the Zazengi. It has been used for almost 1,000 years, about 1,000 years, and is still used today in Zen training. While its authorship is unclear, it is a Chinese work that took its present form about 1,000 years ago. In Japan, it is found in the popular four texts of the Zen school and in the poison-painted drum. That's the basic textbook for Rinzai monastic practice. It is the Zazen manual. Other later writings on Zazen, including those by the Japanese Zen master Dogen, are largely based word for word on it. Brief and to the point, it covers the basics of Zazen meditation, including the physical posture, the mental attitude, and problems that may arise. Let us together look into this classic Zazen manual and apply it so that it too can offer, like an old and trusted Dharma friend, the needed guidance, inspiration, and challenge for us today. Let me first read through, it's only about 2 pages long, so first, I will simply read through without any comment this Zazen manual. Then, as we go through the retreat, I will go through it bit by bit. So by the end of the retreat, you will have a clear eye on what is being said, what is being diagnosed, and how to apply it. Zazen manual. Bodhisattvas aspiring to prajna wisdom should first arouse great compassion, take the four great vows, and cultivate samadhi concentration. Vowing to set all beings free, do not seek liberation for yourself alone. Then let go of all conditions and put all concerns to rest, with body and mind one, no separation between movement and stillness. Be moderate with food and drink, taking neither too much nor too little. Regulate sleep, neither depriving nor indulging. For Zazen, spread a thick mat in a quiet place, loosen your clothing, but maintain proper bearing and sit in full lotus. First, place right foot on left thigh, then left foot on right thigh, or sit in half lotus, placing left foot on right thigh. Next, place right hand on left foot, left hand on right palm, thumbs touching. Raise torso, the upper part of your body, and stretch it forward. Rock side to side, then sit erect. Do not tilt to one side, forward or backward. Align hips, spine, and head like a stupa, but do not strain to make your body erect, as this will constrict breath and cause discomfort. Ears in line with shoulders, nose in line with navel, tongue resting on upper palate, the roof of your mouth, mouth gently closed, eyes slightly open to prevent drowsiness. This is best for sustaining the concentrated power of dhyana. In former times, eminent monks adept in this practice always sat with eyes open. Zen master Fa Yun scolded those sitting with eyes closed, like a ghost cave in a dark mountain. There is good reason for this, which adepts know well. With body settled, regulate breath and relax abdomen. Do not give rise to any thoughts, good or bad. If a thought does arise, be aware of it. Once you are aware of it, it disappears. Eventually, conditions are forgotten, and all is naturally unified. This is the essence of Zazen. Zazen really is the Dharma gate of ease and joy. If people become ill from it, they are not doing it with proper care. Done properly, your whole body naturally becomes light and at ease, spirit fresh, mind clear. The flavor of Dharma sustains, and you are calm, pure, and joyful. If you've already had a realization, it is like a dragon entering water or a tiger roaming mountains. If you have yet to realize it, use the wind to fan the flame. Great effort is not needed. Just confirm yourself and you will not be deceived. Where the path is lofty, however, demons abound, and there are all sorts of experiences, agreeable and disagreeable. Just maintain mindfulness, and none of this can obstruct you. The Surangama Sutra, Tien Tai Chi Kuan, and Guifeng's Manual for Cultivation and Realization describe in detail these demonic states so you can be prepared in advance. Coming out of meditation, move slowly and rise calmly without haste or roughness. Then, at all times, use appropriate means to protect and sustain the concentrated power of dhyana, as if caring for a babe in arms. Thus, it develops easily. This is the most urgent task. If you don't practice calmly and quietly, in the end you will be completely lost. To search for the pearl, it's best to calm the waves with the water of concentration still and clear. The mind pearl reveals itself. Thus, the Perfect Enlightenment Sutra says that unhindered and pure wisdom arises from dhyana. The Lotus Sutra says that in a quiet place, one should cultivate the mind and let it settle so that it is as still as Mount Sumeru. Thus, to transcend secular and sacred, quiet meditation is necessary. To freely pass away sitting or standing is dependent on the concentrated power of dhyana. Even if you devote your life to it, be wary of falling short. And if you waste your time, how in the world will you overcome your karmic hindrances? Thus, an ancient has said that without the concentrated power of dhyana, you will cower at death's door. With eyes covered, you end your life in vain, like a vagabond. Fortunate Dharma friends, please read this manual again and again. For the benefit of oneself as well as others, let us all, together, fully awaken. That is the entire Zazen manual. Please feel free to take a moment to stand and stretch if you'd like. At the beginning of the retreat, Mike, the Jiki, kindly read the one-on-one guidelines, how to do one-on-one. One-on-one is not a progress report. One-on-one is not the place to say, yesterday or at the last retreat, my Zazen or my Samadhi was such and such. Now it is such and such. It has nothing to do with that. One-on-one is simply to not explain, describe, or talk about, but to manifest. Words are not even necessary, but to manifest where you are. It's usually quite clear when you walk in the room anyway, but sometimes it can be helpful for you to express it yourself. Then we can take it from there. Naturally, as our practice together matures, we find that the way we interact with each other is transformed. Marty very humbly spoke of the wrinkle in one-on-one. He spoke of it as a wrinkle, but actually it's a kind of a, perhaps a kind of a necessary development in what we are doing. As we deepen our own practice, it becomes quite natural that it finds its expression in different ways. In silence, oh yes. It's often said, silence is more suitable to Zen than speech. And yet, if you cannot express it, you're only halfway there. There is a rich and very delicate, very profound tradition of Zen literature, poetry, prose, not to mention painting, calligraphy. If it's simply a matter of being silent, what is all that stuff for, huh? So remember, one-on-one is simply an opportunity to be what is present at the moment, to get, to put it another way, to the very bottom of yourself, what you call yourself, with another. In speech, in silence, in act. There's no need to describe or explain, although, as mentioned, if you do have a question, if something is not clear, ask. Ask. And as Marty explained, there is also an opportunity to do that here. You can do it right now if you want, or you can do it at the end of the lecture when there is a chance for anyone to speak up, not just to ask me a question that I answer. Some questions that people ask are better answered by someone else. Someone else may have more experience about that particular question. So anyone is free to speak up from out of the practice. And anyone is free to respond from out of the practice. This is, frankly speaking, the way it has always been. If you read the Zen records, it's been nothing but that. So we are simply, in a sense, continuing, in a sense, returning to the original spirit of what, not just Zen, but really Buddhism, has always been at its best. Let us just look at the first paragraph of this Zazen manual now and to see how much is there, okay? And each day, we will go through more of it so that by the end of the retreat, we will have looked carefully at the entire Zazen manual. Some of you may feel, I already know how to sit. Well, it never hurts to go back again and look at the basics and confirm it for yourself. It can always be helpful to do that, but also to see what to do with the states of mind we may find ourselves in. So we begin with the body, most naturally. It's relatively speaking a lot easier to get the body in order than it is the mind. So we start with this. Once the body is settled and in order, then naturally the mind can be settled and put in order. But the very first paragraph is kind of a general overview, but also giving really the essence. But it's not getting specific yet, so it can be misunderstood. Let me read that first paragraph again of the Zazen manual. Again, it is a manual for spiritual practice. This is not a philosophical statement. It's not a theological treatise. It's a practical manual. And yet, it opens with what may seem a rather vague and grand vista. It says, quote, "Bodhisattvas aspiring to prajna wisdom should first arouse great compassion, take the four great vows, and cultivate samadhi, concentration, vowing to set all beings free. Do not seek liberation for yourself alone." End quote. There are no paragraphs in the original. It's just a continuous Chinese text. But for practical purposes, this is a good place to cut and make the first paragraph. Reading that first paragraph, you might say, this is how we begin? It's a rather high order, huh? But yes, it is where we begin. Let's take a look. It is addressed first to, quote, "Bodhisattvas aspiring to prajna wisdom," end quote. A bodhisattva is literally an awakening being. Bodhi, awakening. Sattva, being. A being of awakening. An awakening being. In other words, you and me. Nothing abstract or vague at all. Prajna wisdom is not mere knowledge or learning. It is the wisdom that liberates, the wisdom of awakening. Wisdom, compassion. Great compassion is also already mentioned in this first sentence. It is, in a sense, where practice must begin. Does this sound daunting or confusing? Are we starting at too high of a place? Perhaps you doubt this great compassion in yourself. So you feel, how can I even get started? Simply start where you are. That's enough. Through proper practice, soon enough it becomes clear. All, including your present struggling practice, arises from great compassion. This compassion is sometimes spoken of as the goal, the end of our practice. It is also the root that grounds and nourishes us. This is not some vague ideal. Where do you think you are right now? But no need to blindly believe my words. give yourself to the practice and confirm it yourself. Next mention in the text is the four great vows, which we just chanted. Simply put, numberless beings set free, endless delusion let go, countless dharma see through, peerless way manifest. Here, too, the first priority, the first vow, is the compassionate vow that sets all beings free. If it is not clear now, fine. Simply continue giving yourself to the practice. To cultivate samadhi concentration, this points to the required discipline, so to speak, especially in the beginning on the zazen cushion. Gathering all into one through patient and sustained meditative concentration, all falls naturally into place. As we will see, this is taken up in the next paragraph and later in the text, where this initial samadhi, as it's called, samadhi concentration, deepens as the text goes on into dhyana. Dhyana is the Sanskrit word that became jhana, that became zen. This first paragraph ends by repeating, in a sense, warning that we practice for all beings, not just for ourselves. Yet most of us, myself included, began practice with ourselves in mind. Fine, start there, but continue with mind and heart open. Let me read that first paragraph one more time. Bodhisattvas aspiring to prajna wisdom should first arouse great compassion. Take the four great vows and cultivate samadhi concentration. Vowing to set all beings free, do not seek liberation for yourself alone. How can you, a flawed person, become a Buddha? Right here and now, what is lacking? What is the living origin, the source of it all? If you realize that, you know what needs to be done. Does anyone have a question? Comment, concern, criticism, condemnation from out of the practice, please feel free to speak up. anything that's not clear, you have a question about, others may have the same question, so please don't hesitate. Yes?
The prajna wisdom, could you go over that again, if that is, please?
In Buddhism, not just Mahayana Buddhism, but in Buddhism, probably from the very beginning, prajna, panna in Pali, huh? And this wisdom, huh? And then compassion, huh? There are terms like karuna, huh? Were considered one way of describing the very basis of Buddhism. Wisdom, prajna wisdom. I use the, it's a rather clunky, prajna wisdom. It just says prajna in the original text, the Chinese characters for that. But to make clear for someone who doesn't understand what prajna is, I call it prajna wisdom, because it's not maybe ordinary wisdom either. The wisdom that liberates. It's not acquiring some new information or changing our viewpoint, for example, from a Christian viewpoint to a Buddhist or Zen viewpoint. It's not that kind of a thing. It's something much more fundamental, you might say. It's simply realizing, for Zen, in your bones, huh, what really is. So we can't say that's simple knowledge. What do we call it? Well, in English, the best word I could come up with is wisdom, as opposed to, you know, intellectual knowledge. Huh? Embodied. There are Japanese expressions that often speak in Zen, taitoku, words like this, which mean physically realized. So it's a wisdom in that sense, to be almost grotesque, you might say, an embodied wisdom. Nothing abstract or theoretical. And the amazing thing is when you realize that, philosophically they would describe it in terms of realizing the emptiness of all things, but that doesn't, that confuses one thing with another. What does that mean? But when you actually realize that, when you actually are that, what I call being without self, it becomes clear that everything is that. It's not a personal realization. Of course, this is intimately connected with why you begin practice for all beings, not just for yourself. You see? That wisdom is not something that I'm learning something about myself. Of course, it is learning what you really are, but in such a profound and penetrating way that with it you directly realize the nature of everything. Because precisely in that realization, you, what you call you, are not separate from any other thing. Do you have a better word than wisdom? If you do, please tell me, and I'll change the translation. But it's very important for this first paragraph to see how it's just the other side of compassion. When you really see things that way, because you are that way, as my teacher, Fukushima Roshi, he often put it, this compassion just wells up from out of that. It just comes. It's not like, oh, now I realize that. Now I have to start caring about people. There's nothing to do with that. You see what I mean? The separation is gone. And so how could you not help someone when their pain is yours? Do you know what I mean? It really is quite literally like two sides of the same coin. And neither one can be lacking. So they're very briefly, it's very brief, it's a very staccato, it's just a bunch of Chinese, a few hundred Chinese characters. It's very staccato, you know? But it's all in there. But in this first paragraph, he's trying to show the facet of the diamond in terms of that. You haven't realized it yet? It doesn't matter. This is how you can see it, simply by giving yourself to the practice. In a way, you're already seeing it now. But maybe you have some doubt. Good. Continue on. Continue on. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Just to follow up on that, I wonder how we might distinguish that from another version of embodied wisdom. You might say that's analogous to, say, a highly skilled basketball player who, in every situation, bodily runs in the right direction, passes in the right direction, sees the whole court all at once and responds to what's emerging at each moment. But in that case, we don't speak of this person had a realization. It's just he or she, through practice, attained such a high degree of body-mind skill that every response was the appropriate one in every situation.
So what's the difference?
I didn't hear you.
So what's the difference?
That's what I was, the one difference I was trying to point to was you wouldn't say, or people don't say, of this player, he or she had a realization.
Well, apart from the words, what's the difference? That's the point, though. That's your question, right?
That is the question.
What is the difference?
Well, I don't see it.
My teacher's teacher back in the late 60s went to America and was somewhat conversant with what was going on here. And he very clearly put it, I thought. I mean, this was over 50 years ago. He already saw it. And he says something like, I wrote about it somewhere. Many people, Japanese as well, not just Americans, but many people naively think that because you are skilled in dancing or piano playing or working, that therefore you are doing Zen, working Zen or laboring Zen. And this is a fundamental misunderstanding. They fail to see the very basic difference between being able to be one in some kind of a basketball or some kind of a particular art, and what in Zen they would call no mind itself.
Yeah, that's why I said this is an analog to. In other words, if you lived your whole life the way the basketball player played, the way I described, how would that be different from the bodily wisdom you were speaking of?
If he did lived his whole life that way,
yes.
Where would there be a difference? Where
I
would
don't
there
see
be?
One, that's why.
Yeah, the thing is, the point I think is that for many artists, musicians, really creative people, there's a tremendous torture, a tremendous struggle that they go through because they're aware when it's there, when they're in the zone, and then they're just, it's unbearable when they're not. They're aware of it, but they don't know how to overcome it. So in a sense, you're quite right. If you would be like that just quite naturally, which is in a sense what Zen is not just aiming at, but that's where it comes from. How else could it be? How else could it really be alive? It doesn't mean you automatically become a surgeon or a master basketball player. But to put it one way, the root delusion is found to be gone, to have never been there. Then we are free to at least leap into whatever is there. Again, that doesn't mean we become completely proficient at everything. Mm-hmm. But the bounds that the self puts on things. Huh? So I would put your question maybe from the other direction. Huh? Why is it that the person who is a great and talented person still struggles so deeply with that? They know there's something still there. It's not uncommon for them to kill themselves, and that's a great tragedy. So that's why we do what we do. That's the best answer I can give, but I think you gave a good answer yourself. So. Thank you.
May I offer a comment on the two sides of the same coin?
As a musician, you must. Please.
Perhaps in order to generate that great compassion towards oneself, and by extension, so to speak, liberate oneself, there's no generating that compassion towards oneself, or by extension one's own thoughts, without generating that compassion for another. There's no generating compassion toward one's own flaws without generating compassion for another's flaws. Because as long as there is a sense of judgment toward another, there can't really be a lack of judgment towards oneself. So in that sense, just I'm offering like a comment, a reiteration perhaps on that idea of the same coin, and that anytime there is a sense of judgment for oneself, there so too is a sense of judgment for another, and vice versa. Anytime there's a sense of compassion for oneself, there's also another.
Yeah, it's a good way of clarifying what that first paragraph is saying. You're turning it the other way in a sense, huh? Yeah. You know, frankly, many of us, maybe almost all of us, come to the practice because we are suffering. You know what I mean? Oh, you know, I like to save the other person too, but this is my suffering, and that's what brings many of us to the practice. That's not good or bad. It's just the way it is. But that's why it's so important to practice properly, to have the right guidance, so that you can take, okay, let's take that. And really, you know, you can't just say, okay, now let's think about other people. You know, it's not going to work that way. By going into the very source of that, it becomes clear that one, that I that I was seeking so desperately to solve all my problems so I won't have any more of that suffering, huh? Is itself a great suffering, a great delusion. And to the extent that we are in direct, even to say contact is not quite right, with the pain and the suffering of the other, it is our pain, then how can you not? Are we always going to be like the master basketball? Or are we always going to make the three-pointer? No. Are people always going to understand and agree with, that was a very compassionate thing to do? No. But that doesn't matter. That's secondary. It is important to try to be as accurate as possible. For example, not to do it just out of sentiment, to try to do it as accurately as possible. But then it's done. When it's done, it's done. Do you know what I mean? The intended effect is important. If you keep seeing you're trying to help somebody and they keep getting more and more messed up, well, you might want to reevaluate what's going on. But at the same time, you don't want to be obsessed with that. If you can just do it because you are not separate from that pain, then in a sense, good has already come. In the Buddhist sense, you can say good has already come. That's why we can say ridiculous, preposterous things like numberless beings set free. You see? It comes to be that way. Are we now going to have a perfect world when we leave? Is there going to be no more problems? Of course not. That's the ego. You see what I mean? That's the self trying to get to a place where all of my problems will be solved. That's the delusion.
Just as we also won't be forever missing out on all of those really preposterous thoughts that come into our being, so also we won't be saved from interacting with people whose maybe flawed interactions weren't intended on our part after all of our sacred, pure work.
Yes, yes. You know, after that retreat in England, actually it was maybe a year ago, not the same retreat, but there was a guy whose wife is a doctor, and she's not a Zen aficionado. She puts up with her husband going, but she doesn't really like it. They have a daughter, and she would like him to be home. But he came to this retreat in the UK, and he had a very deep experience. And when he went home, he told me later, his wife opened the door, and she said, "You're glowing." And now she doesn't mind if he goes to retreats. And I even stay with them sometimes. But she's still not so interested in doing Zazen, but she sees that it's good, and it's true, and it's real, because she can see what happened to her husband, you know? It was very cute. There was another guy at that same retreat who, a journalist, kind of a hook-nosed, tall guy, and he went to that same retreat. He had never done one before. He's kind of a Sufi mystic. He had never done a Zen retreat, but he went one-on-one. He was right there, had a really, really good retreat, and he told me later he was driving home from Surrey to London, where he lives. London, it was a beautiful blue, it was like today. It was perfect weather. He turned on the radio. The soccer game was on, and I forget what team he was. They scored 3 points while I was in the car. 3 goals, my team. He gets home. He can't find his key. He just did a 5-day retreat, so he can't find his house key, so he knocks on the door. His 21-year-old daughter opens it and looks, takes one look and goes, "Gandhi's home." But he had no, you know, intention like that. Just like the other guy didn't try to glow, but it was just there. And some people can see it, and some people, you know, especially children, your own children. Gandhi's home. The funny thing is, the next retreat, his wife came. And I was thinking, maybe when they go now, Mother Teresa's home too. But in a way, it doesn't matter. Do you know what I mean? We do all that we can, and then it's done. Because in a way, how can you measure it? You know. Today they thought you were ridiculous. They laughed at you. Okay, well tomorrow, they may see it a different way. Or then again, maybe you needed to be laughed at. Who knows? Who knows? But when you can do it with that pure heart, I won't say it's enough, but it's a good start. But it's a good start. Thanks for your comments. Huh? I think it's time for a 10-minute break. Thank you all for your questions and your comments and for listening so intently. We will continue with the Zazen manual again tomorrow.